You know, some airplanes earn their retirement. They fly their missions, they bring their crews home, and they get parked somewhere nice where people can come pay their respects. But the Memphis Belle, she didn't get that. Not for a long, long time. I'm Taildragger, and this is The Hangar on Radio Hangar, and today I want to tell you about a restoration that almost didn't happen, on an airplane that almost rotted away to nothing while a whole country just watched. Pull up a chair for this one, it's got everything. Neglect, politics, and about 200,000 hours of volunteer labor. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So let's go back to May of 1943. The Memphis Belle, a Boeing B-17F Flying Fortress, serial number 41-24585, has just completed her 25th combat mission over Europe. 25. That was the magic number. That was the number the 8th Air Force said you had to hit before you and your crew could rotate home. And the Belle and her crew, led by Captain Robert Morgan, were one of the first B-17 crews in the entire 8th Air Force to actually make it to 25. I say one of the first because there's a debate about whether the Hell's Angels crew technically beat them by a few days. But the Belle got the publicity. And oh, did she get publicity. The Army Air Forces brought her home on a war bond tour. They flew her city to city across the United States. William Wyler, the Hollywood director, made a documentary about her. She was painted up with that famous nose art, the bathing beauty designed after a sweetheart back in Memphis. And for a while, she was the most recognized airplane in the world, more famous than any fighter, any transport, any other bomber in the fleet. She was proof that you could go to war in a B-17 and come home alive. But here's the thing about fame, it fades. After the war bond tour, the Belle was declared surplus. The Army didn't need her anymore. Memphis wanted her. So in 1946, the city of Memphis, Tennessee, took possession of the airplane. They put her on display at the National Guard Armory, and that's where the trouble started. Now, here's where it gets interesting, or rather, here's where it gets heartbreaking. Because for the next 3 decades, the Memphis Belle sat outdoors, in Memphis. If you know anything about the Tennessee climate, you know what that means. Humidity, rain, blazing summer sun, freezing winter nights, and the city, bless their hearts, they just didn't have the money or the expertise to take care of a 65-foot-long aluminum bomber. By the late 1970s, the Belle was in rough shape, the skin was corroding, the plexiglass was clouded and cracked. Vandals had broken into her and stolen instruments, knobs, anything they could pry loose. Birds were nesting inside the fuselage. Rain was pooling on the wing surfaces and seeping into the structure. The nose art was fading. The engines were seized up with rust. She looked like a ghost of herself, sitting there on a concrete pad behind a chain-link fence in a Memphis park. There were local efforts to save her. A group called the Memphis Belle Memorial Association formed and fought hard to get her some kind of shelter. They raised money. They put up a temporary pavilion over her in the mid-80s, but it wasn't enough. The damage was deep, structural, the kind of corrosion that eats an airplane from the inside out, where you can't even see it happening. And then the debate started. Who should have her? Memphis said she belonged to them. She was named for a Memphis girl, Margaret Polk. She'd been in Memphis for decades, but the National Museum of the United States Air Force out at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio. They wanted her too. They had the facilities, the expertise, the climate-controlled hangars. They could actually save her. This went back and forth for years. Years. City councils, congressional representatives, preservation groups, veterans organizations, everybody had an opinion. It got heated. People in Memphis felt like Dayton was trying to steal their airplane. People in Dayton felt like Memphis was letting a national treasure rot into the ground. Finally, in 2004, the Air Force made the call. The Memphis Belle was moving to Dayton. And I'll tell you, the day they loaded that airplane onto trucks and drove her out of Memphis, there were people standing on the roadside crying. Some of them angry, some of them relieved, but all of them knowing that an era was ending. She arrived at the museum's restoration facility in October of 2005, and when the restoration team got their first really thorough look at what they were dealing with, I think a few of them probably wanted to cry too. The corrosion was worse than anyone had publicly admitted. Whole sections of skin had to be replaced. The wing spars, the structural backbone of the airplane, had significant damage. The control surfaces were shot. The landing gear had been frozen in position for so long that the hydraulic seals had turned to powder. Inside the fuselage, decades of water intrusion had left some of the aluminum so thin you could push a finger through it. And here's the thing that made this restoration different from just about any other warbird project in history. The museum didn't want to rebuild the Memphis Belle. They wanted to restore her. There's a big difference. A rebuild means you take what's left, use it as a template, and essentially construct a new airplane around the bones of the old one. A restoration means you save every original piece you possibly can, every rivet, every patch, every dent that a mechanic put there in 1943. The team at Wright-Patterson treated this airplane like an archaeological artifact, because that's what she was. Those patches on the fuselage? Some of them covered flak damage from missions over Germany. That wear pattern on the pilot seat? Robert Morgan sat there. Those scratches on the instrument panel? A flight engineer's hands made those while he was adjusting the fuel mixture on the way to hit a target in occupied France. So they worked slowly, carefully. They documented everything. Every piece that came off the airplane was photographed, cataloged, and stored. When they had to fabricate new skin panels, they matched the alloy, the thickness, the rivet pattern, exactly. They tracked down original parts from other B-17 wrecks and salvage yards. They found original instruments, original hardware, original fixtures.
The nose art alone took months. The museum brought in conservators, not painters, conservators the same kind of professionals who work on Renaissance paintings. They stabilized the original artwork where they could and carefully recreated the portions that had been lost to weathering. The engines were a project unto themselves. Those four Wright R1920 Cyclone radials had been sitting exposed to the elements for the better part of 60 years. The museum team didn't just clean them up, they disassembled each engine, treated every component for corrosion, replaced what couldn't be saved, and reassembled them to display condition. Now they're not running engines. Nobody's going to start the Memphis Belle's motors again, but they look exactly like they did when they were pulling that airplane over the English Channel. The interior restoration was where the real detective work came in. Over the decades, so many parts had been stolen or lost that the team had to research exactly what the cockpit, the bombardier station, the radio room, the waist gunner positions, the ball turret, and the tail gunner station would have looked like in May of 1943. Not a generic B-17F interior, the Memphis Belle's specific interior. They used wartime photographs, maintenance records, crew interviews, anything they could find. Robert Morgan himself, before he passed away in 2004, had provided detailed descriptions of the airplane's layout. The ball turret was a particular challenge. If you've never seen a Sperry ball turret up close, it's basically a glass and steel sphere that hung from the belly of the B-17 with a man curled up inside it. Finding an original, intact Sperry turret assembly was like finding a unicorn, but they found one. Let me give you a sense of the scale of this project. The restoration team included both paid museum staff and a rotating crew of volunteers. Many of those volunteers were retired aircraft mechanics, some of them former military guys who had worked on heavy aircraft their whole careers and wanted to spend their retirement saving one. They put in over 200,000 man-hours of labor. 200,000. That's roughly the equivalent of one person working 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for about 100 years.
The project ran from 2005 to 2018. 13 years. 13 years of painstaking, rivet by rivet, panel by panel work. And during that time, the museum kept the public updated. You could watch the progress. You could see the airplane slowly coming back to life in their restoration hangar. And people came from all over the country to watch through the viewing windows. Veterans, families of veterans, aviation enthusiasts, kids who had never seen a B-17 before. They all came to watch the Belle come back. On May 17, 2018, exactly 75 years after the Memphis Belle completed her 25th mission, the museum unveiled the completed restoration in a brand new display in the museum's World War II gallery. They rolled her out in front of a crowd that included surviving family members of the original crew, military officials, museum staff, and those volunteers who had given years of their lives to the project. I've seen photographs of that day, and I've talked to people who were there. They said when the curtain came back and the Belle was sitting there under the lights, gleaming, complete, looking like she had just taxied in from a mission, the room went silent for a moment, and then the applause started. And it didn't stop for a long time. She's displayed with her bomb bay doors open, so you can look up inside her. The nose art is vivid and sharp. The olive drab paint has that slightly worn look that an operational warbird would have had after 25 missions. The guns are in place. The oxygen bottles are mounted. The radios are installed. It's as close to a time machine as you're going to find without actually climbing into one. And here's what gets me about this story. It almost didn't happen. There were points during those decades in Memphis where the Belle was close to being beyond saving. If the corrosion had gone just a little further, if the structural damage had been just a little worse, the museum team might have looked at her and said, "There's not enough airplane left here to restore. We'd be building a replica, not saving the original."
But they got her in time. Barely. And the lesson there, for anyone who cares about preserving these machines, is that every year you wait, every year an airplane sits uncovered, unprotected, exposed to the weather and the vandals and the indifference, it gets harder. And eventually it becomes impossible.
There are warbirds sitting in fields and backyards and municipal parks right now that are on the same trajectory the Memphis Belle was on, and most of them don't have a national museum waiting to step in. The Belle is safe now. She's climate-controlled, professionally maintained, visited by hundreds of thousands of people every year. She's doing the job she was brought home to do in 1943, reminding people what those crews did and what it cost. I pulled most of today's story from the National Museum of the United States Air Force's own documentation and Roger Freeman's Histories of the 8th Air Force, both of which are worth your time. If you want to see the Belle yourself, get to Dayton, it's worth the trip. Find us at radiohanger.com. This is Tail Dragger. Go see her if you can. She waited 75 years for somebody to take care of her. The least we can do is show up.